And welcome back, everyone, to the Cold War Cast. I am your host, Ryan Llewellyn. This is a podcast where we discuss the history and the pop culture of the Cold War. Today, we're going to talk about Austria during the Cold War, and more specifically, their neutrality during the Cold War. This is a topic I've been thinking about lately because it's been thrown out there that is one of the things Russia is currently looking for Ukraine. And as I'm recording this, it's, I believe, the 12th of April of 2020. And, the war is not resolved. Maybe I'll add some of my thoughts to that at the end of the episode. But that is one thing that's being tossed out as a Russian demand, that the nation of Ukraine becomes officially neutral. And, well, there's historical precedent for that in Austria during the Cold War, as we'll learn today. And I guess maybe there's even some parallels between Austria and the Ukraine insofar as being next to another country with very similar cultural and linguistic ties. Austria with Germany, of course, that was an issue before World War II, and then Ukraine and Russia, how one country kind of looms larger over the other in both these cases. But another reason why I've been thinking about Austria in the Cold War is around January, I read a biography from Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, if you grew up when I did, so, you know, late 80s, early 90s, pretty much every boy was a fan of Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, we all loved Predator and Terminator and all that. So his biography was kind of cool, I thought. He's just always been somebody I've liked. And the Cold War really loomed large in his early life growing up in Austria. For one, his dad was a member of the National Police Force, the gendarmes, I believe they were. And he would get called up to the border between Austria and Hungary or Czechoslovakia, you know, whatever it was at the time, sometimes when there'd be flare-ups between East and West. And then, of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger served in the Austrian army as a young man, which I believe probably makes him the second most well-known Austrian military figure of all time. And he talks a lot about how he was a tank driver, and, you know, how they really trained for the Russians coming into their country someday. And even as a kid, that was something that everyone around him always feared, was the prospect of the Russians invading. It didn't sound like Arnold was the most reliable soldier that the Austrian army had ever had. There's a famous story that I've heard him tell a few times about how he snuck away from base when he was in basic training to enter, I think it was the Mr. Europe bodybuilding competition, which he won, and talked himself out of trouble because he said that he owed his success to the Austrian army or something like that. And then apparently once he accidentally ran his tank through a brick wall, got in some trouble for that. But his biography was pretty good. And, you know, of course, being into the Cold War, these moments like this really stick out. So, I would recommend it if you like Arnold Schwarzenegger, too. Just a guy that's, really made his legacy, I guess, during that period of the late Cold War. So anyway, Austria and I guess specifically the city of Vienna were Cold War hotspots just because of the neutrality, and it was a real interface between the East and Western world. So today we're going to talk about how it got that way. All right, so the story of this begins when Austria was absorbed into Germany in 1938 during the Anschluss. And this was something that, I don't know, it's really hard to make sense out of historically, because there was a good amount of support for Austria's reunification with the German-speaking world. And at the same time, too, a lot of it was done by German coercion and strong arming. So just one of those complex situations. And I'm sure the further you get away from the historical event, the more distance people would want to put, based on how everything worked out between Austrian desires at the time and now, basically, to have a little bit of distance from the Nazi era. But anyway, Austria was incorporated into Germany in 1938. This didn't play very well in the West. Just like today, if, let's say, the Donbass region of Ukraine gets absorbed into Russia, there are a lot of people in the Donbass region that would like to see that happen. And, there are plenty of people that would not want to see that happen in the Donbass region and outside of there. And it would be something that would take strong arming from a larger country, in this case, Russia, to make that happen. But the Western world looked on this askance. We've all seen The Sound of Music and all that. And I think generally in the Western world, it's looked at now as it was back then as being an underhanded move by a more powerful neighbor to incorporate Austria into the German Reich. Now, this topic was officially addressed by the Allied powers in 1943, I believe. This was during the with the Declaration of Moscow, when the war, really, the tide turned for the Allies, and it was looking like they were gonna win this thing. So they started to talk about how the post-war world was going to look. And among other things, they established that they believed that Austria was the first victim of Germany in World War II. But they put a little asterisk by this and also said that at the same time that Austria was still complicit in the Third Reich's war against the rest of the world. And it is true that there was plenty of Austrians, standing shoulder to shoulder with the Germans in all the worst activities that happened during that war. Some Austrians had to be drug kicking and screaming, and others not so much. But they determined that when and if the Allied forces made it into Austria, they would view it as a liberation, as opposed to conquering, I guess, an enemy. But also at the same time, acknowledging that they were the bad guys too, and so it kind of put Austria in a weird position. But anyway, as fate would have it, the Red Army stepped foot in Austria in March 29th of 1945. And almost immediately after that, the Vienna Offensive began, which was one of the bigger ones of the Eastern Front. And just as a side note, I think it's interesting that with mainstream study of World War II, of course, typically in the Western world, but pretty much everyone listening to this, we tend to look at more of the Western Front and the American, the British participation in the war more so than Soviet, for good reason, because we identify with it more. But when we look at the Eastern Front, you have Barbarossa, then the Battle of Stalingrad, and then pretty much just a bunch of silence until the Red Army's trying to bust down doors in Berlin, it seems like. We kind of overlook the experience, the Red Army experience of coming into Europe. And there were a lot of very big battles. And of course, the Vienna Offensive was one of these. So as the curtain was closing for Austria, a former politician by the name of Karl Renner, I believe he was a prime minister of Austria, in his earlier days, he reached out to the Red Army and struck a deal with them, basically, that he would be their guy to administer things in Austria. And they took him up on the offer. And on April 20th of 1945, Austria declared her independence from Germany. Now, this generally is what the Allied nations wanted, was for Austria to be independent and unyoke them from Germany. But this Karl Renner guy, he put about one third of the cabinet positions that he could fill were dyed-in-the-wool communist. So, of course, that didn't play well with the Western allies. It was viewed as the Soviet Union setting up a puppet state in Austria. So the West didn't recognize the legitimacy of Renner's government. And meanwhile, I suppose I should add that the nation of Austria was really suffering a lot of rape and plunder from the Red Army at this time. Just, you know, we've probably all read the stories of what happened to Germany when the Red Army came. And it was the same for Austria, too. They, you know, of course, had status of an enemy, but, you know, maybe it was a little bit different. Eventually, the commanders, the Soviet commanders, had to address the problem head on and make some very harsh statements that, you know, the soldiers need to knock it off. And they didn't quite do the same thing with Germany, at least not so soon after the war was ending. But they had to really try to put a stop on it in Austria, just because Austria was a nation that could potentially be a friend. Anyway, so the Soviet Union had boots on the ground first. Like I said, they crossed over in the final days of March, and the Americans were the next to step foot in Austria, and that was at the end of April, April 26th of 1945. And I know in a very, very long ago episode, we talked about the Allied invasion of Germany and how towards the end there, everybody knew that it was important to have a hold of land, because it wasn't so much about the war right then, it was what's going to come afterwards. So the Americans wanted possession of as much as possible, you know, the Western allies and so forth, just so the Soviets couldn't possess, and vice versa. So the Americans cross into Austria. You know, if there was more trust, I guess, between the Soviets and the other allies, you know, maybe they could have had a more coordinated, you know, seamless invasion of Germany. But towards the end there, it just kind of turned into a little bit of a free-for-all. And the French got in there on the 29th of April, and the British were tail end Charlie here on May 2nd, and that's when they got their feet on the ground there in Austria. Now, just like Germany, Austria was divided up into sectors that, you know, loosely corresponded with the way Germany was divided as well, too. So there was a British section, an American section, a French section, and a Soviet one. And this is interesting. Just like Berlin, the city of Vienna was turned into an international zone. And, well, just like Berlin, there was the sectors. And in the heart of the city, in the historical area where most of the cultural and government buildings are, that was considered an international zone. And whoever was running that zone, it would rotate between the powers. And I forgot exactly how they did that, but, you know, it was something where, you know, let's just say like the Soviets have it this month and then the Americans next month and so on and so on. There's actually a really good movie that I did an episode about years ago called The Third Man that deals with a lot of Cold War intrigue. It's an Orson Welles movie from 1949. And it takes place in Vienna, and you get to see a lot of this, the way it was administered by all the different Allied factions. And it is a really good movie. It's one I should actually watch again recently, or soon, I guess I should say. Anyway, while Austria was trying to get a civilian government together, it was ran by military governors. And then eventually, in October of 45, Renner had a guy come onto his cabinet named Karl Gruber, who was a vociferous anti-communist. You know, there was just no doubt about this guy being firmly aligned with the West as the Secretary of State. So, you know, pretty high position. And that was enough to win over the legitimacy of the government in Vienna. And by the way, Karl Renner was a guy that was definitely respected in the West. I know Harry Truman liked the guy, so it wasn't necessarily that he was scummy or politically abhorrent or anything like this, but they just viewed it as he was under the control of the Soviets. So they actually liked the guy, but you know, he wasn't doing what they wanted. It was agreed that Austria was going to hold elections in November of 45. And the elections turned out to be disappointing to everybody, pretty much. The communists, they came in with less than 5% of the votes. So, you know, obviously that was a bit of an embarrassment to the Soviet Union. And the guy that won, he won in a landslide, actually, was a guy named Julius Raab. And this was a guy that had, I guess you could say, Nazi ties. I don't know if he was actually a member of the Nazi party, but he was definitely adjacent to it ideologically. And so when this happened, immediately after World War II, they were still talking about denazification and all that. And the election was basically thrown out under their parliamentary rules, which, you know, of course, it was a kind of a new establishment. So it might have been a little murky there. And they ended up putting a guy in charge named Leopold Figl. I believe that's how you pronounce it. And he became, the Chancellor of Austria. In order to keep firm control over Austria, all parties from the Allies agreed that they should be able to overturn anything that the Austrian government did that they deemed unsatisfactory for any reason. And what the Allied powers, the four military governors, agreed to was that if anything that the Austrians did was to be overturned, it would have to be unanimous amongst all of the Allied powers. So as you can imagine, there was probably a lot of back and forth between the Allied powers here. So, you know, if the Soviets wanted something overturned, odds are the Americans, British, and French didn't, and vice versa. If, you know, the Americans want something overturned, there's a pretty good chance that the Soviets didn't. So the only thing I could really see is if there was any strong Nazi tendencies that, you know, it would get a unanimous overturn. As you can imagine, an environment like this, the political instability, you know, plus all the destruction from the war and all that, probably wreaked havoc on the Austrian society and economy, and it definitely did. In 1947, there was a pretty big famine in Austria. Those were lean years throughout Europe, but particularly so in Austria. And Austria was also saddled with some of the costs of the occupation, which was not a cheap endeavor for anybody. It cost a lot of money to keep all those troops there, and they had Austria pay not an insignificant proportion of it. And at the same time, this was a problem from the Soviets, that there was, I guess you would say, reparations that they were paying themselves from the Austrians, that they were taking, machinery, oil, you name it, basically. Now, what they had agreed to was, because Austria was a belligerent nation, but kind of, sort of, not really, that the only things that they could really take would be German external assets. So anything that had any assets that had ties to Germany, the Soviets were able to take. Now, if you think about a country like Austria that's going to have strong trade ties with Germany, no matter what, just because of cultural and language connections, then of course they were part of Germany for, the 7 years basically during the war. A lot of industry, I'm sure, was set up there to keep the war going and all of that. So it was probably pretty easy to make the case that damn near anything had ties to Germany at some point. So the Soviets were able to take quite a bit from them. Now, in order to create some stability for Austria and to attempt to roll back some of the Soviet influence, the United States implemented the Marshall Plan in 1948, and Austria received a lot of money. I believe per capita, Austria received the most money out of any nation from the Marshall Plan. And it did have a big effect on their economy. It really did help them. And one thing that's interesting about the Marshall Plan in Austria was that some of the money, a not insignificant amount, I think it was almost like a quarter of the money that was earmarked for Austria, ended up going to the Soviet zone. So that's the only time where American Marshall Plan money went to the Soviet sphere. And that was because the civil government of Austria knew that if the Soviet sectors were stable, that would keep things stable throughout the whole country. You know, you couldn't just ignore one part, for the sake of another. But at the same time, they could read the writing on the wall, and they knew that it was likely that Austria could be a place where the East and West clash in Europe. The Korean War was going on at the time we're talking about now, so early 50s, and they were really conscious of the prospect of something similar to that happening on European soil. So one thing that happened was, and I believe the British started this, is they weren't able to have a standing army, but they had the gendarmes, the national police force, and they were really militarizing these guys. So they were almost like an army. So, when I talked about Arnold Schwarzenegger's dad, when he was a kid and he'd have to go protect the Austrian border against, whenever something would happen in Czechoslovakia or Hungary, during the uprisings, the big ones that they had when Arnold would have been a kid. So these are these guys. And also the Americans started bringing in military equipment and just creating large stockpiles. So, just in case our friendly guys in Austria, if they needed it against the Soviets, well, it would be there. The Soviets did that too, to some extent, and in their area too, where they would just magically leave tanks and all this for them too. But Fortunately for Austria, it wasn't strategically very important to either power, but at the same time, they wouldn't want the other side to have it. So the status quo there was agreeable to both sides. Had things been a little bit different with Yugoslavia, you know, maybe Austria would be a little bit more of a hot commodity. But just at the way things were looking, as the way the Cold War world was shaping up, Austria wasn't terribly important strategically. So, and it cost them a lot of money to do this, you know, again, a potential flashpoint. So they were able to start talking about maybe walking some of the occupation of Austria back. I think it was a situation where both sides were kind of surprised to find out that neither side really wanted it. Now, the Soviet foreign minister, Molotov, he's a very prominent guy, of course. He made it clear, and I should also say this is right after Stalin had died. So, you know, things between East and West were kind of starting to chill out a little bit. But he said he would be okay with both sides pulling out of Austria as long as it was agreed that the Austrians would not host any foreign bases and they would declare neutrality and also agree to never reunite with Germany again. This actually sounds a lot like what the Russians are asking for with the Ukraine, that they declare neutrality. You know, a big reason this war is being fought is due to the prospect of NATO bases being very close to the Russian heartland. And, you know, I guess I don't know if they're really all that concerned with Ukraine entering the EU if they were ever invited, but you know, maybe that's an issue, but definitely NATO. Anyway, this was agreed to in May of 1955, and by October, the end of October that year, the all the troops had pulled out of Austria, and on the very next day that the last troop left, and October 26th of 1955, the Austrian Parliament issued their declaration of neutrality. And among other things, they agreed that, well, they would be a neutral nation. And that neutrality was more or less adhered to throughout the Cold War and even to the present day. Austria never joined NATO. Now, they are considered a partner for peace for NATO, which I believe Russia is as well, too. So, you know, take that for what you were. So they're viewed as kind of a adjacent country to the Western alliance. But at the same time, Austria has been considered a Western country, that you would speak of it in the same breath as you would, you know, France or Germany or whatever. Now, during the Cold War, they did consider their position as a neutral nation as a little perilous, that, well, the Soviets could renege on the deal and come back in. So just like I was talking about how Arnold talks about as a kid, they were worried about that. And, you know, they had their nuclear bunkers and, you know, the drills, what to do if the Soviets came and all of that. And their army was geared towards fighting off a potential Soviet invasion. Economically, they were in a pretty good position because their neutral status allowed them to trade openly with the West and also the countries of Eastern Europe as well, too. So Austria, you know, historically, you could think of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and, you know, the connection that Vienna would have with places like Prague and Budapest and all this. And those ties were maintained. So there were trade ties between Eastern Europe and all that Eastern Europe had to offer. The city of Vienna really was considered an interface between the Western and Eastern worlds, where both sides could come together. There were quite a few high-level discussions that would take place in Vienna just because of their neutral status. And also, it was a place where the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc sometimes would acquire Western technology through Austrian firms that would have ties with the Western world, but no real scruples about dealing with the commies either. I think unofficially, it was always assumed that Austria had more Western-leaning tendencies, and I think that's a fair assessment. And it was always important for Washington and London and so forth to maintain strong ties with the government in Vienna and really court them as not necessarily a Cold War ally, but kind of keep things a little bit in the West's favor. And I think that Austria kind of smarted a little bit at the end of the Cold War when Washington deemed relations between Austria weren't quite so important. They were just another European country as opposed to one where we needed to keep some leverage. So that's the story of Austria's neutral experience during the Cold War in, a very nutshell from, mile high perspective. And I think this history is probably on the minds of the Russian side of this war right now, where they would really like to see something like this with the Ukraine. Personally, I don't know. I think had they tried to get a deal like this a few years ago, would have been a lot more likely, but I don't know. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure in the West for the Ukraine to not make a deal like that, just because it's going to be seen as appeasement to a very belligerent adversary here. And as I conclude here, one thing that I think is interesting is that, or I guess in a way kind of sad, is the affairs of smaller nations really being determined by much larger and much more powerful neighbors. I recall early in the conflict with Ukraine, President Zelensky making some sort of comment to President Biden, via the media that, there was a comment about that Biden made about the Russians making a minor incursion, or rather, if they made a minor incursion into the Ukraine, that, maybe we could just shrug it off. But Zelensky making a comment, and probably rightfully so, back to Biden, saying that, an incursion to our country is not a minor affair. And, it may be minor to you, but it's pretty damn significant to us. That it takes some arrogance and lack of perspective, I guess, to really dismiss something like that as being insignificant or minor. Like, let's say that, Red Dawn happened in the United States and, Russian paratroopers landed in Colorado, we wouldn't say, oh, it's just a little incursion, so, whatever. Now, for what it's worth, Austria seemed to enjoy their neutral status and continue to this day. I saw a recent poll, a recent enough poll where, 75% of the country or something resembling that had no desire whatsoever to join NATO. And, they were even a little hesitant to join the EU, it looks like, too. But, they eventually did in the mid-90s. But there's something about twisting a country's arm to get it to agree to not take a side that, you know, seems a little harsh. But, you know, as those of us who study conflict and history already know, the world can be a really messy place sometimes. And that was true back then, and it's still true. Nothing's really changed. All right, so I'm going to leave it there. Like I said in the past couple episodes, I'm going to do a few more Cold War episodes that tie into the situation in Ukraine. And I've got kind of a fun one coming up too, that, or at least I think it will be fun. Now, if you want to support me, the best way to do it is go to reddragonherbs.net and get yourself some loose leaf tea. Here shortly, probably the next couple weeks or so, we'll start doing some Mother's Day boxes. So keep your eyes out for those. Those are going to be cool. You know, even if you don't want a box, tea makes a very good Mother's Day gift, and that's coming up very soon. And as always, if you need any recommendations, feel free to hit me up, and I will be glad to help you. So right now, also, if you want to get in touch with me, the best way to do it is Instagram. But I am getting ready to fire up Twitter again. I took some time off the Cold War Cast Twitter, but the account is still active, and I'm going to start using that a little bit more. So there we have it, and I will talk to you very soon. Thanks for listening.